Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's a Sunday. It's 10 p.m. here in Central Europe, and it's all different times in all different locations. Now, some of you may be arriving early. Some of you may be arriving late because finally, after 2-3 weeks in limbo, the American and European spring summer reckoning of time has finally equalized. And there have been discussions at the level of the European Union to rescind it, but those guys never get anything done. Well, nothing good ever comes out of Brussels. You know, all kinds of bullshit comes out of Brussels, but something useful, something smart, like getting rid of this stupid changing of clocks and disarticulation we have with America, not going to happen, I guess. And with me tonight is none other than Mr. Ryan Sanchez, also sometime known as culture war criminal. And he has, of course, come to the right place because I come from the Balkans. We have a lot of experience with war crimes, especially culture war crimes. This is how things... Yeah, so you come to the best place to perfect and hone your craft, Mr. Sanchez. How are you doing today?
Good. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you accepting to be here and gracing us with your presence. I know it's early. I know it's high noon over there in California, and you're wearing a coat. So I appreciate the sacrifice you're making. I wouldn't make it. No, certainly I wouldn't. Oh, I've done episodes of this shows and nothing but my shirt sleeves. But
Part of what part of my brand is I always wear a suit for political actions. And you know, my body's had to adapt to the, you know, warm temperatures here in California. I actually get cold very easily because my body is so used to being overheating.
That's amazing. You know, I was wondering this I wasn't exactly wondering about this. Mrs. Gilby was wondering about this because she's the fashion, aficionado or fashion obsessed person in our family. Is like, how did people used to wear suits all the time back in the day? I mean, right in the middle of summer, people would wear suits. And I'm like, I don't know. And I guess something similar took place to the temperature perception change you have experienced. And before we get into the discussion itself, before we get into it with Ryan, I'm going to call you Ryan instead of CWC.
Yeah, go ahead.
CWC, to people of my generation, it's, I hope you don't take this the wrong way, Christian Weston Chandler. So
yeah, so I get that a lot. I actually did that on purpose.
Right.
So it's harder to dox me. It's negative SEO, you know.
Oh, it's...
Everyone, you know, they search CBC on Kiwi Farms, you know, they see Chris Chan.
Well, you got to throw those bales of hay wrapped in aluminum. You got to squirt out that squid ink, I guess. I should have thought of that. I had this harebrained idea about an assassin infiltrating Japan under the false name of Llewellyn Riordan, just to mess with the Japanese. One of those hundreds of thousands of novels I've thought up, but I'm never going to write. But before we get into it, we have some crass financial concerns to address. People, Countercurrents is raising money. We're going to build institutions. We're going to build an infrastructure to help raise up young leaders such as Mr. Sanchez, as anyone who is willing to speak up for the rights of white people, for the survival of white people, anyone who's really not anti-white, we are, for the time being at least, his friends. And we're gonna be needing money to do that. And to that end, we are having a fundraiser. So you can send us money through Cash App. That's cash.app/dollarcountercurrents. You can zap us money through that. Now, the transaction fees there are much lower. However, you cannot post questions to me or Ryan through Cash App. To do that, you got to use Entropy. Now, they've been having trouble lately as well, but they're all we have. Countercurrents has been financially deplatformed from I believe, 6 payment processors. And if you want to use your credit card, your plastic money to help Countercurrents, you got to use Entropy. And you can also ask me questions. You can ask Ryan questions. You can give your comments there. You can even give me money just to insult me. I'll read it out. I have no ego. I just have a tiny little notebook, which is several pages, several hundreds of pages long by this now, people who have insulted me. But I'm sure that will become relevant really far into the future. Pay no attention to the notebook. And with that, I gotta acknowledge our debt to our sponsors, Alaska Chaga Tea. Alaska Chaga, the exotic fungal tea from the land of Alaska. I don't know the state's nickname. Sorry about that. Not American. It is full of antioxidants. It is what keeps me going. It's what keeps me so sexy and my skin so smooth and silky. It's
what kind of tea is podcast. It? What kind of tea?
It's a fungal tea. It's a mushroom.
Fungal tea. Okay.
Right. It's a mushroom. It grows on the birch trees in Alaska. And the fine people at Alaska Chaga scrape it off the birch tree, and I'll send it to you for boiling consumption. So that's how it goes, okay. Right? It's if I could live stream smell, this is amazing, right? And I suppose this is the last time I'll be drinking it warm, because the weather is seriously warming up here. So next show, I might actually be drinking iced Alaska Chaga. Just prepare a great big batch of it and drink it iced. I know the Z-Man drinks it like that. He's a frequent guest on this show. And yeah, it's a phenomenal product. I think we're done with the shilling part. This time I'm really just talking about how awesome this tea is. It tastes good, smells good, and it keeps you healthy. And my grandfather says that it helped him with his bowel problems. I did not inquire much more into that, but it's apparently also good for your bowels.
We'll take his word for it.
Yeah, I'm going to take my grandpa's word for it. Yeah, I always listen to my grandpa. So I think that's enough advertisement, panhandling, and crass financial concerns for today. Ryan, well, we have a big crowd here at Countercurrents, but somehow I don't think a lot of them have heard of you. It's probably a generational thing. Our audience skews a bit older, millennial, Gen X. So why don't you introduce yourself to our crowd here for starters?
Sure. Well, first off, thank you for having me again. My name is Ryan Sanchez. I'm a nationalist activist here in California. I'm 23 years old. I've been involved in pro-white advocacy for my entire adult life. I've been doing this since I was 15. I was in Identity Europa. I was working with America First, and now I am organizing independently here in Southern California. And I am a streamer. I have a show on Odyssey, and I am on Telegram at Culture War Criminal. And I've been working with a crew of nationalists. We meet up every week, and we have guys running for office locally, and we're having a lot of success working with the local community.
Now, Southern California, that's a heavy couple of words over there. A lot of people, conservatives, white nationalists, alt-light, everyone's like, I think they all agree California is lost. But personally, and I've never been to the place, I know California from playing GTA, but I tend not to agree. You look at California, it had an enormous number of Trump voters, even though Trump obviously lost California in 2016 as well as 2020. But you have all of these inland white people living in California, and even some conservative Latinos who may not... just the concentration of these types of people may mean that region of America is not yet completely lost to our kind of politicking. Would you agree with that?
Well, I have a few points to make. First off, there's more white people in California than any other state. So we have a responsibility as advocates for our people to reach out and minister to these people. Secondly, you mentioned, you know, you've never been to California, but, you know, as a European, you know California well through Hollywood movies, Grand Theft Auto. And I feel like, yes, you know, we do have a very tough uphill battle here, but California is so iconic, so beautiful. The setting here, the history, I feel like we can really win a propaganda victory that can inspire our people. If we're able to grow our nationalist cause, if we're able to advocate proudly and firmly for our people out here in California, and most importantly, through social media, if we're able to broadcast it to the world, I think we can inspire. Because if we could do it here, we could do it anywhere. And I like a challenge.
Yeah. Well, there's been a saying for a long time, as California goes, so goes the nation.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, that's some delicious chaga. And yeah, it is. It is. This is me saying this is delicious chaga. And, you know, I've played enough GTA, driven through Red County in San Andreas enough times to know that, no, this is not just a place that's been flooded with Mexicans and you know, all of these Central American, Latin American squatters, illegal immigrants. People, yes, it's been tipped over to the Democrat Party by a combination of you know, white liberals, Jewish liberals living in gated communities, and all sorts of immigrants inhabiting Los Angeles. But yeah, there's a lot of white people in California, and it used to be a red state not 30 years ago, you could say. That's something to keep in mind. And besides, numbers aren't everything. I am, of course, one of those people who keeps bringing up elite theory. If you have a small, dedicated, well-organized group of people, you can do a lot of things. You can do a lot of miraculous things. And it's actually what I'm trying to cultivate here. And, of course, other people in our movement are trying to cultivate on Countercurrents, on the Writer's Block. And I'm just glad we have a man in Southern California, as we do elsewhere in the country.
Yes, well, the vanguardist strategy, as Lenin put it, or the elite strategy, having a small group of dedicated people, I think is perfect for California, because as our European viewers can probably relate to, even if you're in a country that's 95% white, if the people aren't, they haven't woken up, if they're not politically engaged, you know, it doesn't really matter how many people you have. Whereas in California, the changes have happened so quickly and so aggressively that it's actually forced our people to wake up and become more aggressive. And the persecution that pro-white activists have been undergoing for the last 5, 6, 10 years here in SoCal, by the legal system, by Antifa, the men that remain are very tough. And I'm surrounded, and I'm very blessed to be surrounded by such great friends, men that I've been working with for years who are totally dedicated to the cause. And I feel like the quality of men that we have here in Orange County, I truly believe that I have the best group of nationalists in the entire country.
That's good to know. You know, hard times, they create strong men. And well, you're in a tough place there, Mr. Sanchez.
Yeah.
People, just to dispel, you know, the obvious thing, Sanchez, that's Spanish, not Mexican, right?
Of course. I like to make the comparison to when my family first came to what is now America in the 1680s. You know, the demographics were even worse than they are now. So, like I said, you know, my ancestors, my people have always been able to deal with overwhelming odds, and I welcome it.
Right. Well, of course, back then, our people, we knew where our balls were. We had backbone. We had we had the will to conquer. We had the will to survive. That's one of those things. I've heard it somewhere that in the 8th century, the 9th century, the Moors invaded Spain and took over all of Spain except for, you know, tiny, inaccessible Asturias, which was so mountainous and logistically inaccessible, the Moorish Sultan just deemed it not worth it. And up there in Asturias, you know, Visigothic, what eventually became Spanish culture, was buttoned up for so long. When it finally exploded out against the Moors, it did not stop until it hit Patagonia, all the way over in Argentina. And I believe something like that is liable to happen also with our predicament, even as we are pressured, even as the vicissitudes of our age trim away the fat from white people as a collective. What remains shall be, well, something to be reckoned with, I presume, unless some of the black pill people. Just a second. Yes, that's Odyssey. Apparently, Odyssey has found itself. It's found, and we have finally found our voice on Odyssey.
Oh,
we are
wonderful.
Streaming on how diversity is taking its toll on children's friendship. I guess someone didn't turn off the last stream. Okay, that these things happen, you know, with this.
Oh, okay. Technology. So it's competing streams.
Yeah, it's one of those things, I guess. Maybe some other time, or maybe right now, if you're up for it. I've been asked several times to do a stream on white people in Latin America, but I don't suppose you would be knowledgeable about that, Ryan.
I have some cousins who lived in South America. I'm not really one to talk. You know, I'd have to talk to my family about their stories and then relay them to you. I'm sure you can find somebody better to talk about that topic. I mean, I feel like I am a white person living in Latin America, living in California at this point, honestly. But to your earlier point, though, you know, the Reconquista, 780 years of holy war. I think we need to really have a realistic view of what we're facing here. The struggle that we are fighting right now is going to be a multi-generational one. And as advocates, as fighters for our people, we need to have the understanding that we very well may not live to see the victory. And we need to have the discipline and the long-term mindset because, like I said, it took about 780 years for my ancestors to drive back the Saracens, the Moors, out of Spain. And it took a further, 300 years to conquer the New World and turn it Christian and white. So it's no surprise that undoing all this damage is also going to take a long time. And I think it's a good thing because struggle makes a people strong. And we should actually hope that this struggle goes on for as long as possible because that means more generations of heroes are going to follow us. So the history books are going to be full with our exploits. I am sure of it.
I'm certainly, but I do shudder to think about what school children of the future will learn about. They're going to have to memorize all of my eccentricities. They're going to, I heard it somewhere commented on a stream that historians of the future, what are they going to make of ninjaginis and lemons and diamonds? And ultimately, I guess chaga will survive as a species. People will know what chaga is. Or maybe it will just recede into legend, like Soma, the thing that the Indian Brahmins took.
Or ambrosia.
Yeah, and all of these things. Maybe there will be no more chaga. There will be just the memories of chaga. And the ninjaginis, I guess, they will be an artifact. It's interesting to think about what we're doing as if we are historic personages of the future. I don't think that people like Ferdinand and Isabella or Magellan or George Washington really thought of what I'm doing is going to be history of someday. Hold on a second.
I think they did, actually, in my opinion.
Yeah. That's definitely possible. I don't know if, we lost connection.
The stream's down.
Yeah. Oh, God damn it.
Shut it down.
In any case, well, I might as well just read out the DLive donations right now. We had 14 lemons from Slog. And thank you for that, as usual, Slog with the 14 lemons and an ice cream from Bartleby. Well, this is the writer's block, apparently streaming only on Odyssey. You were saying something, Ryan. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
I think we were talking about whether or not these historical figures viewed themselves as historical figures. I think some of them did. I know Caesar was really self-conscious, and he felt like he was a loser compared to Alexander the Great, you know, so some of them do. And I think we do need to be aware of our role, our place in history, you know, without getting, you know, too arrogant and thinking too highly of ourselves. We still need to view ourselves as operating within the flow of history, you know, where we are just the current generation. We're serving our tour of duty on earth for our people. And instead of that individualistic, you know, Rick and Morty philosophy, like, oh, we're just on a rock in space, you know, we're just meat bags, like that stupid leftist mentality that makes people do nothing with their lives.
That's interesting. Although I will say that as a Macedonian trying to live in the shadow of Alexander, trying to live up to being Alexander, you're on a fool's errand. And I don't think his achievements can or even should be repeated. He did, like, I always thought that Philip II was the far greater statesman, he was a nation builder. He built up a nation. He built up the kingdom of Macedon from a confederation of squabbling tribes. And he was his father's third son, right? He was not even meant to be the king, but he somehow managed to do it. He somehow managed to establish this proto-feudal type organization, proto-feudal type state way back in the ancient era, 300 odd years before Christ. And it's what's amazing. Now, Alexander took that and crushed the Persian Empire with it. But if he had just stuck to his father's plan of conquering Anatolia and setting up a few buffer kingdoms, maybe he would have lived. He would have never had the glory, but maybe the Hellenic world wouldn't have, you know, rushed into its own destruction at the time. But who knows? Yeah. Speaking of that, you came out of Identity Evropa. I'm sounding like Charlie Kirk.
Evropa.
you came out of Identify Evropa. It's exactly how a person of Hebrew faith would say it. But you also came out of America First. Now, if you would give us the backstory of that, I know you did not leave America First on the best of terms. So if you would just fill in our audience on what happened over there.
Sure. Well, I was the main AF organizer out here in California. Mm-hmm. I held events. I started streaming in right after the election, and my channel grew very rapidly. I built up a really robust and productive group of America First supporters around me. And we met up, and we still meet up, you know, at least once a week. We did memorial vigils for Ashley Babbitt, the woman who was killed in the Capitol. And the theme of my channel was always getting offline. I was the main AF streamer who actually would do IRL streaming that was explicitly political, not for mere entertainment. And I would always demand of my audience, you know, do push-ups. Like, one thing I would do is, oftentimes during my shows, I would do a push-up break where I'd have everybody do as many push-ups as they could, and then they would say in the chat how many they did, and they would watch themselves improve. And I ended up clashing with some of these the other streamers, because I said, you know what, our people are in danger, our country is in danger, we need to be doing more, we can't just be playing video games, we need to go outside more. And there are some streamers that are making a lot of money, so we need to make sure that the money is being used to actually further the cause. And I was kicked out for that, pretty much. Ridiculous.
Well, that's cruel. So basically, by telling people that they should self-improve, and basically telling your fellow Groiper generals, I believe the term was, that they should marshal their troops, they should train their troops to be literally the best that America can offer.
Yeah.
That was the reason you were drummed out of America first.
Yeah, they didn't feel like I fit with the corporate culture, if you will. You know, they said I was too serious, you know. I'm a gamer. I'm 23. You know, I grew up playing the same games. I'm a few months younger than Nick Fuentes. We play the same video games. It's not like I hate video games, but I also understand the need for discipline, fitness. If we're going to win, we need to be as strong as possible.
Right. I mean, but you know what? They're not counter signaling gaming.
No, of course not. But you know, part of being a man is knowing everything has to be in moderation. And I sound like my father saying this. It's crazy, but I guess, you know, being the voice of reason. Sorry guys, you know, we gotta balance the play with the work. Newsflash. I don't know if that's news to anybody, but but you know what? I'm still organizing. You know, I still believe in the message of America First, because America First is the indigenous, it is the traditional American political philosophy. You know, Charles Lindbergh was America First, Pat Buchanan was America First. The idea that we are going to put our country above everything else is a mantra that is incredibly popular with our people. And to that end, I still meet with people every week. My channel is still growing, and despite the best efforts of the haters, you know what? I still think that America First is inevitable. Maybe not in the way that some people envision it, some grifters, but serious political actors that want to put America first, that actually want to make these Christian values popular again, people that want to join with their fellow patriots in this brotherhood and actually hold each other to a higher standard and become the best men we can be, that spirit is still very much alive here in California.
Interesting, because that's been my problem with what America First became, right? Sometimes people list me as a Nick hater. I made the block list on Gab back when America First was pretending to take over Gab or whatever, but I don't know if people remember this. I debated Jim Goad, well, it's been more than a year ago, on the subject of is America First useful as an organization, and I took the position that yes, actually, America First has the potential to do great things. I was, you could call me an early friend of America First, covered the Groiper Wars, basically attempted to give it direction. I correctly identified it as a place where right-wing cadre can be cultivated, by which I mean people can, through America First, be trained to become political actors, savvy political actors, which can serve as staff for Congress people, for governors, for eventually presidents. See, one of the things we saw as a great big weakness of the Trump administration was that he could not draw personnel to implement the policy of 2016, Make America Great Again. The MAGA agenda of 2016 was subverted because there was no personnel to push that policy, and personnel was policy. In the absence of a recruitment pool, Trump hired GOP stalwarts, neocons, you know, these disgusting people who call themselves conservatives, right? And
yes,
this was a problem. And I thought that America First could provide the personnel to, maybe, you know, it was too late for the Trump administration at this point, but maybe a right-wing governor here, a conservative senator there, basically there was an opportunity to build a cadre farm, a cadre factory for populists, for nationalists, for, dare I say it, identitarians. What do you think the potential of such an organization is? Do you think such an organization can still arise in America at the national level?
For sure. Actually, you know, one of the projects of America First was the America First Students Organization. And that was supposed to follow up the very successful Groyper War, where Charlie Kirk was hounded by Groypers, such as myself. You know, the most successful of those was at UCLA, where Donald Trump Jr. Got heckled down by a huge crowd of America Firsters.
Oh, I remember that. It was glorious.
And a large group of those men were from my crew around here. Some of them are actually with me in the room. That's where I met them. We're still friends to this day. So America First Students was then, okay, we struck this blow against Turning Point USA. How are we going to follow it up? Well, we're going to create a rival organization that is going to actually advance nationalist values, advocate for our people. And we were going to get all of these people that were sympathizers of America First in the College Republicans. They were going to then defect and form America First Students. And in fact, a few very brave and articulate young men, disproportionately here in California, once again, they actually did publicly throw their names and reputations on the line behind America First Students. They were doxxed, harassed, persecuted. And America First Students, nothing came of it. The guy who was supposed to run it ended up just doing gaming streams. And to this day, he just does gaming streams. So these young men got doxxed for absolutely no reason. The organization, they had a Discord server with all the chapter leaders in it. And the leadership never even like went online. So these guys were just doxxed for nothing, essentially, which is a huge waste of... not only is it a strategic error because they lost their strategic initiative, they should have pushed the attack and actually built a robust organization. But what is further disturbing is the fact that, again, young men were doxxed and persecuted, and they weren't given any support for that, which is a shame. Because I think as a leader, you have a sacred responsibility to your men. If they suffer on your orders, you should do your damnedest to help them out as much as possible. And, you know, you mentioned the recruiting pool that Trump lacked, and that was his undoing. You know, there is an America First internship program, and there's some extremely talented men that are in the internship program. They're making graphics, music, all this stuff for Nick. There is talent there. It just needs to be used more efficiently, you know, like running candidates. Nick said they were going to have America First candidates. The America First Foundation was going to support these people. A good friend of mine, a America First supporter here in California, Nick Torres, he said, you know what? I'm an America First fan. I'm going to run for Congress. And he wears the America First hat. And, you know, Nick promised a endorsement, which never came. He's like, you know, I don't think you're a fit for the for what we're trying to do here. You know, he didn't think he was going to win because, again, riding off California. So this guy is getting all this all these attacks in the media for being America First supporter. He gets written off. And some of the Groyper generals accuse this guy of being a Fed just because they didn't like me. Because at this point we had a falling out. And since they knew that I was friends with him, in order to get at me, they baselessly accused this poor guy of being a Fed, even though he has always been loyal to Nick. And he actually was upset at me for having the falling out with Nick. Mm-hmm. They just don't care about these guys. And finally, probably the most egregious of all of this is January 6th. multiple America Firsters were arrested. You know, most famously, Christian Secor, one of the he carried the America First flag into the Capitol. He sat in Mike Pence's chair. It was it was badass. No support from no mention, no support, no and that's all. He's the only one that we truly know of. But there were multiple America Firsters that were arrested. We don't know their status. We don't know if they're on house arrest, if they're still in the DC gulag getting tortured. No money has been raised for them. You know, money was raised for this Baked Alaska guy who's already a rich kid, but none of these guys got any help, which begs the question, why? Why not? You know?
That's another... This is very disheartening, especially the treatment of Nick Torres, right? That he's getting... He's catching flack. He's being unfairly accused of being a federal agent. Just because he's your friend, if you would allow me to venture an analogy, I read once, like 100 years ago, I read an essay by Murray Rothbard, which details basically how the Ayn Rand people, the objectivist movement, would become, and how when the split between Ayn Rand and Nathaniel Brandon came, people would get purged simply for holding the wrong opinion re Nathaniel Brandon. And the split was really because these people, the objectivists, they were a bunch of, I guess we're an Odyssey, so I can say it, they were a bunch of degenerate Jews having sex with each other, having sex with each other's wives and husbands. And this is the real reason behind it. And I'm sorry to say, having one and once had great hope for Nick Fuentes, having supported him in as much as I can in my function as a writer for Countercurrents and as a voice on the dissident right. When people were saying he doesn't go hard enough, I said, well, he doesn't really have to, right? That's the other thing. People say to me, well, why do you disagree with Nick Fuentes? And I say, I don't. Ideologically, I'm more or less the same as him, mm-hmm. right? And I just call myself a white nationalist. I know he doesn't. But no, he and I, there's very little space between us ideologically. I just don't think that throwing your people under the bus is good optics, right? We were talking about optics, and optics, I don't think optics was ever about ideology. Optics is about presentation. You know, take a shower, pick out a suit that fits, don't throw your people under the bus.
You know, Nick's theory, his conception of optics is, to this day, I think, is that he described it in the best way possible. You know, he did a stream where he used the example of a speech that Mike Enoch and Richard Spencer gave, and he muted the audio, and he simply invited the audience to look at the visual of the speech. You know, the two men were standing awkwardly apart from each other. There was no background. No signs, nothing. And his criticism of the optics was not about anything those guys were saying. He was merely saying that they could have done it better to make it look more visually interesting. You know, optics are incredibly important. And, you know, I've been to many AF events. You know, there's fat people there. There's guys that are really skinny. You know, fitness is a huge part of optics. Having our guys work out, you know, putting the strong guys in the front of the crowd, you know, moving some of the more flabby guys to the back. It sounds cruel, but again, savvy political people, that's what propaganda is. You know, you need to delegate tasks. You need to have a guy in charge of doing stuff like that. You know, if you don't want to be the guy, if Nick doesn't want to be the guy that's rude enough to tell the fat guys to get to the back of the crowd, delegate somebody to do it. It's like, you know, Nick had an event at CPAC after he got banned from Twitter. And that was the first time I met him. And actually, that was the second time I met him, because I met him when he came to California for his White Boy Summer trip. But I was at CPAC. His stream went down. His interns couldn't figure it out. So I saved the event because everybody went to my stream, which had tens of thousands of people watching all of a sudden. I usually have 100. I used to have like 100 people watching. All of a sudden, I had like 20,000 people watching my stream. So they're watching that. And then people kept heckling him during his speech. Some guys like, Telegram, Telegram. It really cringe. Like there's a bunch of drunk guys. So then I had to hand my stream to the guy sitting next to me. I got up and I escorted like five people out. I literally dragged one by one, five people out of the hall because they kept freaking heckling him. And none of the people that are his generals had the, you know, the presence of mind to kick these guys out. And like two of them tried to fight me because they were totally drunk. So I'm like, okay, he literally hired security guards. He had these big guys in suits, you know, like standing behind him. So his security guards didn't kick out the hecklers. His generals didn't, you know. It's like, you know what? Leadership, you got to delegate tasks. And you know what? Nick is a smart guy. He has some smart political takes. He's a good speaker. He's a good entertainer. But you know what, Nick? If you're listening to this, you know, you don't like people criticizing you, but bro, you can't do it all. You can't be the master of everything. That's just part of being human. So you got to find people to be your subordinates and have them do other things. It's just, but he surrounded himself with a bunch of idiots, you know, like Beards and Beardly.
It is like, basically when I was, and a little deep lore on me, I used to be an attorney for 6 years, right? Okay. Before I decided to go full time into racism. And, I think that I always ran a very tight ship in my practice because I'm so lazy, right? I hate working. I really don't like working. So I usually delegate everything that needs to be done to people who actually know how to do it competently. And this is when I realized my experience was that the job of a manager, the job of the leader, is really at the beginning, at the moment of the construction of the organization, when getting you from zero to one, really. You get a bunch of people who know how to do their jobs. You get them all lined up, you know, like we're playing Rome Total War, where you're determining the disposition of your troops. And you know, because, you know, we're both gamers and I'm a Rome Total War gamer. Sorry, I'm just old.
I was playing that yesterday.
It's an awesome game. I'm going to throw this piece of shit Mac out of the window once we're done, because it now no longer tolerates 32-bit apps, and I can no longer play Rome Total War on it. It's tragedy. You know, that's the life of the Apple cuck. What can I say? And this is the role of the leader. The role of the manager is to get a bunch of good people into the organization, put them in the proper roles. And once that is done, your job is to motivate them. And then you're free to take 3-hour lunches and visit your mistress during working hours. You can actually do that when you're the leader, in as much as you have constructed a well-oiled machine, which is going to do the work, which is going to respect the telos of the organization. That's leadership to me. I mean, that's how I understood it. And the Prussian military, we like the Prussian military on this channel. They had the Prussian military manual said, you find people who are stupid and lazy. You know, this is like 95% of people. They are going to be soldiers, right? You can motivate them with money and beatings. Then you're going to have people who are smart and hardworking. These guys are precious. You put them on the general staff. Then you're going to have people who are lazy and smart. These people are suited for command because they know how to delegate and they don't panic. Then you have people who are stupid and hardworking. These are people who are to be kept out of the army and under no circumstances given any responsibility whatsoever, because they're going to find something very stupid and work very efficiently towards it. So that's my general heuristic for people. If you're, you know, like I wouldn't say I'm smart, but I am very lazy. So naturally, I'm going to do the leadership thing. And another thing about the fat guys, the schlubby guys, the maybe not so well-groomed guys, Well, as someone who is, I'm also a work in progress, you know, put on quite a lot of weight during the corona years, finally getting fit, finally getting back to my pre-corona levels of fitness. And like many aging jocks, I still have the food consumption of someone, you know, burning 6,000 calories a day, proving to be a problem in my frail dotage. But I will say, you can get a lot of mileage out of picking out the right suit. A lot of the guys I saw in pictures from AFPAC, you know, the people were making fun of them that they were fat or too skinny. I said, well, you know, whether you're fat and skinny, that's, you can fix fat and you can fix that, but it's going to take some time. It's going to take you a couple of years.
The suit is everything.
Yeah. You got to pick out the right suit, right?
Yeah.
I think you're the suit expert here, Ryan.
Yeah, you know, that's something I've gotten into menswear over the last few years. It's a big passion of mine. And that was a common theme of my show last year. I would talk about fashion and stuff. But as to your what you're saying about the Prussian military, you know, I was in the Marine Corps. I saw how, you know, a organization with good leadership can mold, you know, men, everyday people, into the best version of themselves. And there's still a lot of extremely stupid people in the military. Don't get me wrong, but it's about having the leadership. And the thing about the Marine Corps is Marine Corps officers are held to a higher standard than the men. You know, they are very physically fit, and they're inspiring for that. And leaving the Marine Corps, you know, I was actually kicked out of the Marine Corps by the government for being associated with RAM, the Rise Above Movement. There was a big purge of the U.S. military, which, you know, I come from a military family, a long legacy. I always wanted to be a career officer my entire life. So getting that taken from me was really horrible. But I was like, you know what? I'm going to serve my country by going full time into the movement and advocating for our people, because the rot is really deep in this country. But going from the Marine Corps and then seeing how, like, childish the nationalist movement is, I mean, that was a complete culture shock. I was like, you know, we need to do some real changes here.
Right.
It's just it really is ridiculous. Like we really have to institute some kind of like basic physical fitness standards, some kind of real tough self-criticism, if you will, you know, because it's not hard to get fit, you know, because I feel we're all young. You know, we're men. Most of us are young, but it's if we have that passion for a cause, because God knows we are essentially soldiers. You know, we're political soldiers fighting this. We're definitely getting persecuted. We're definitely living a tough life doing what we're doing. So we just need to transmute that shared suffering and make that into forge the bonds between men that actually results in building a cohesive organization. So the potential is there. We just need leaders to actually give people the kick in the pants that they need.
What you're saying dovetails excellently with what Frode Midjord's been saying for the past, I believe, four months now, saying that because we are in this mindset that we're desperate for people in the dissident right, in the nationalist right, we just take just any sort of garbage. We just pick it up off the street. Anyone who's even vaguely not anti-white, we accept him into the inner circle. This is a very wrong approach to take. And another thing you mentioned about us being soldiers, if we are indeed soldiers, we need to learn to obey orders. That's another thing. I mean, there is a lot. There's, you know, anyone who's been in dissident politics knows we have the chronic problem of too many chiefs, not enough Indians. Well, sometimes the best thing you can do is, like I have my disagreements with Dr. Greg Johnson, the editor of Crown Occurrence, but whenever I want to have one of my prima donna moments, I remember the cause. I remember what I'm fighting for. So I don't have a prima donna moment, or I have it privately somewhere where people cannot see. And there is no recording devices, because I think we've learned from the Octoroon meltdown over in Charlottesville, although it was very amusing. I believe people would find it amusing if I started hurling words like that. But this is we're not here to goof around. We're here to do serious work. And part of that serious work is fundraising. We have donations. People have donated. People want their money's worth, I guess. So there's questions for us on Entropy. And there is a question for us from Branson Cleary, who donates $50 American and asks, Normie Republicans are passing anti-CRT legislation in several states and laying the groundwork to muzzle anti-white teachers in public schools, but not necessarily for the reasons we want them to. Is it prudent for us to join in with Democrats or the real racists if it accomplishes something that would improve our lives locally? And if Ryan would, you would give your answer there.
So on that note, you know, a lot of the rhetoric that we see in the mainstream media is CRT hurts black people more than, you know, whatever. But in my experience, you know, I actually went to a town hall with a congressional candidate. I'm sorry. A gubernatorial candidate, a candidate for the California governor. And I asked him, I said, I explicitly asked him, if elected governor, will you make it illegal to do anti-white discrimination? And he explicitly said yes. And everybody, all these moms thanked me after the event, because people do know it is anti-white. So yeah, even though the media says it, even though our fake leaders try to make these stupid arguments like Charlie Kirk. I do sincerely believe that the people hate CRT because it is anti-white. Everybody gets it. I mean, even Tucker Carlson says that it's anti-white racism. So I think we can join the fight against CRT without saying that Democrats are the real racists. Because if we can, now that we've normalized the anti-CRT crusade, it's not that much of a leap to then normalize saying anti-white. So we should help ban CRT and also push it even farther and say it's anti-white discrimination.
This dovetails with my thinking on the subject. Now, anyone who reads Countercurrents regularly will know I have a couple of articles up relating to this subject. But my general rule of thumb is, if normie Republicans are doing something good, don't interrupt them. They're doing it for bad reasons. Point out that they're doing it for bad reasons. But beyond that, don't interfere in their work and build on it, right? They want to ban CRT. We want to go a step further. We want maybe to use our local influence in as much as we have it to have pro-white education, to educate children on their, you know, glorious past, on what our people are capable of accomplishing, why those things are good things, right? I think we can always build on the foundation laid. And yeah, don't interrupt the normie Republicans if they're doing something good, even if their motivations may be, well, let's face it, cringe. And if someone's trying to protect, you know, he's going to ban anti-white propaganda, but he's doing it to protect Asians, I'm not going to mind. You know,
of course.
It's just one of those things, I guess. We have, I think that's the question well and truly answered, unless you have anything to add, Ryan.
Well, I will just say, you know, yeah, you're right. Even if he's doing it to help Asians, we should still support it. But I mean, he did explicitly say, I mean, the videos on my Telegram, he did like specifically say, you know, we need to ban anti-white discrimination. So I think, the main takeaway I want people to get here is, again, I'm keeping up the fight here in California, which everybody perceives to be extremely left, which, I mean, it is. But I'm telling you, from my personal experience, you know, white advocacy is normalized. You know, like maybe the people that are public figures aren't going to want to acknowledge it on camera. But, you know, I talk to a lot of these candidates, you know, behind the scenes. I talk to people at events. I'm telling you guys, like, the Overton window has definitely shifted. It didn't just shift itself, of course. It was through the blood, sweat, and tears and sacrifices of a lot of people for many years. but it is shifting. And we really have to make the push. We really have to keep up the fight and actually go out and talk to our kinsmen, our fellow white people, our fellow Americans. You know, now is not the time to be retreating into the woods. Now is the time to be doubling and tripling down, because I really think we have the potential to normalize these ideas in a big way, even more.
The way you're describing this, and this is interesting, that we know from the Virginia gubernatorial election, right? Mm-hmm. That basically it wasn't just normie conservatives activating themselves against CRT. It was suburban white people in general, like people who may be liberal on other issues. Like they may be liberal on, I don't know, weed or gay rights. They, because they're white, because their children are being spoon-fed this garbage, right, at schools, were activated and were organized themselves to oppose it. And it did lead to the unfortunate effect of electing a stool sample like Glenn Youngkin. But hey, you take your victories where you can, I guess. So this is actually excellent, and this is essentially how the dissident movement, how identitarians can move forward. We do have a good deal of moral influence, because our cause is moral. It's inevitable. It's just. In order to defeat us, the enemy has to deplatform, has to lie, has to slander. Now, if we can control the frame of discourse, and we can control the frame of discourse insofar as we don't descend into, you know, infighting bullshit and just bad optics, we can actually do quite a lot of damage to the enemy narrative. And that's, I guess, good enough for me.
Indeed. And we've made so much progress with that. And, you know, you talk about suburban moms, you know, being a big part of this. Right. You know, Antifa has really come after me in here in SoCal. They really fear me because, you know, I've been holding, getting ready for the trucker convoy. You know, I held a mass meeting in Huntington Beach. We had over 60, primarily, you know, moms and grandmas show up. They came to my event, and I talked strategy and tactics for the convoy. It's funny because I feel like more than half my supporters are, you know, white moms, white grandmothers, because at the end of the day, you know, optics, if, you know, you're like, I'm speaking the truth, you know, I like to think I try to, you know, be clean cut, and I try to just be friendly with people. And that's what Antifa fears the most. You know, they fear somebody that's actually able to, you know, push a pro-white message, but actually win over normal people with families. And there's a Twitter post. Someone said, this big Antifa lady on Twitter, she said, Orange County white nationalist Ryan Sanchez is turning PTA moms into domestic terrorists. I'll post the link here.
Jesus,
it's so funny.
Fucking Christ.
I mean, like they're absolutely seething about me, you know. They're making me out to be this like this big threat, you know. And the way they describe a lot of like the America First people, they would, you know, call them incels, call them, you know, they like mock them. But one thing I've noticed is the coverage of me has always been, they never mock me. They fear me. You know, they say I'm like, I mean, they say the most crazy stuff. I mean, there's articles written. They were really scared about the trucker convoy, how I was one of the organizers in California of it. They're like, white nationalists are taking over. They're giving these mothers marching orders for this insurrectionist army. You know, it's insane. They like the thing that scares them the most by far is working with normal people. Because, you know, being a skinhead, being, you know, how do you say it? I hate to say like Wignat, but, you know, being like what is considered like a classical overt white nationalist that is more of a revolutionary, you know, more of a vanguard, like where they're not trying to win over the masses. Like that does scare them. But I think they get a different kind of fear when it's when you know, white advocates are able to actually get soccer moms to ask questions about, oh, what's the Frankfurt School? What's white genocide? Then they go, oh my gosh, you know, the evil whites, you know, their blood, they're going to wake up and they're just going to start killing us. You know, oh my God. Like, they have this irrational fear of just everyday white people. I really think that they fear white families almost more than they fear people that are openly opposing their agenda. I don't know what it is, but they really do fear us.
I think the fear is that, see, I think the vanguardist approach works. So the vanguard's been in the Bonduke. So it's like, okay, we use the war metaphor. Now we're going to use the explorer, the conquistador metaphor, right?
Love it.
We are the people, the vanguard, because I consider myself a vanguardist. We're the people who are crazy enough to go into this continent full of savages, full of dangerous animals, full of jungle. We're going to hack at it with a machete until some gold yields back. And maybe, you know, 99 times of 100, you become food for cannibals, jaguars, or just drown in some fucking swamp. But every once in a while, you come back to the king of Spain with a fuckload of gold. And that's the general idea. You know, some of these people, like I was looking at some, I was watching some documentary, and they did like a brief psychological profile of Hernan Cortes, right? And it's like, yeah, this guy was probably a psychopath, right? Probably, maybe not a psychopath, maybe sociopathic leaning. And the reality of it is, and I know it could have been just anti-white propaganda trying to smear this great man, but the reality is he was probably not a normie either, right? He was not neurotypical. He was probably some sort of neurodivergent. We know that Christopher Columbus was a little eccentric. We know a lot of these people who came out and were settlers, pioneers, and explorers were a little weird, you know, by normal standards. And by the time normal people started moving into the New World, it was 200-300 years, right? Entire families moving, like in New England. The yeah, people so who came over here first, I mean, over there, because I'm, but, you know, also over here, because in a sense, you know, Macedonia has its own storied history.
You know, maybe around. You're right. Maybe all the conquistadors, all the settlers, like maybe my ancestors were all just like autists, you know, maybe that's why I'm the way I am today. Maybe I just come from a long line of crazy people that are like, you know what, we're going to leave Extremadura and we're going to go to this untamed continent. Cause I don't know. And you know, maybe all the guys that are playing Hearts of Iron 4 and Rome Total War all day, maybe they would have been the conquistadores of the past. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned this on Twitter, like, there's a bunch of dudes out there, right? They're brilliant geniuses. Like, I play Crusader Kings, Rome Total War, Mountain Blade. You know, sometimes I bribe homeless people to follow me around because just so I can play Mountain Blade in real life. That was awesome.
I see what you did there.
Follow CWC, follow Ryan on Telegram. It's hilarious sometimes. And but there's guys out there who are like leagues above me at playing these games. And I'm like, if this weren't a crazy fucked up world we were living in, this guy probably would have been some sort of general or administrator running a big empire, right? And you think about it, the kinds of people who become explorers, and it's like, yeah, they're not normal people. I was reading about this, like the guys who cooked up the Mad Doctrine during the Cold War, essentially, or basically who are at any level involved in geostrategic planning with nukes and everything like that. There's not a single one of them that's sane by normal standards. They're all either psychos or autistics, right? But those are the only kinds of people who can function at that level, I guess. And so the whole Wignat phenomenon, it's real, right? But at some point, you're in the weeds and you hack away enough jungle so that normal people can actually start traversing the path. Now, at that time, you actually become a little bit more of a liability to the movement than an asset. And I guess there's a passing of the old, you know, death of the old West moment. Like, yeah, there's no more room for the frontiersman in the Old West. And it's tragic. His role has been served. And I believe we are coming to such an inflection point that the guys who actually hacked out the path for us, right? And, you know, maybe I'm considered one of those weird, eccentric guys who maybe hacked out the straight and narrow path. Maybe I'm just a transitional figure. Maybe I'm only mildly eccentric. But we're going to have to make way for the Karens, for the normies, for people with families, for people with, dare I say it, jobs, hawk ptui, right? They're going to have to keep trudging along.
Well, I do think, you know, we need to... I do, you know, believe in the vanguardist approach, for what it's worth. And I do think, you know, we need to carry the revolution. You know, we do need to maintain what got us here in the first place. You know, we can't lose sight of the goal. Frankly, I think it's more of a question of optics, honestly. I think we need men that are just as, if not even more radical, even more fanatical and dedicated. They just have to be incredibly disciplined at, having the revolutionary discipline to have good optics, and they have to be able to win over, donors, and be able to be liked by the masses, essentially the people, so they can lead a mass movement. Cause the goal of the vanguardist approach is to eventually, of course, lead a mass movement in the future. You're just trying to maintain this cadre. And, as far as building a vanguard, so, you know, I got kicked out of the AF movement, and unfortunately, you know, when that happened, it wasn't just me that was being punished. It was all the men that I work with. And, you know, what made me so angry about this, and look, I don't like talking about inter-movement drama. I think it is, like, counterproductive, and I think our enemies love it. But look, you know, when I got kicked out, you know, I was funding activism with my super chat money. You know, I wasn't making that much. You know, rent's expensive. I pay $1,200 a month for my share of the rent for this tiny little apartment I'm in. Gas is $6.15 a gallon here. US dollars a gallon. And it's very expensive. But you know what? We were able to do all this activism without any support from any other organization, just from the generosity of our viewers. And now that, you know, I'm not with AF anymore, it's harder for me to get viewers and donations because I'm not able to network, because this drama happened 6 months ago. And I was going to go to an event called 76 Fest, which was a 3-day camping trip in the mountains of Arizona. There's going to be some congressmen there. And I was going to be speaking, and I was actually going to be teaching a class on land navigation, because I was a Boy Scout, I was an Eagle Scout camp counselor. And I want to teach, you know, the guys at this camping trip some skills, and I want to network with these other activists and congresspeople. But these AF people threatened the organizers and got me banned from the event, even though I hadn't, like, fought or, you know, struck at them for 6 months. So it's like, look, I've come to the realization that no one's going to save us. We have to be self-reliant. And I owe it to my friends who are being still persecuted by Antifa, who are still being persecuted by the system. You know, we need to build these institutions for our own self-preservation. So I'm building a project called the Nationalist Network. I am building a network of streamers, much like America First, of nationalists that have good optics, who are strong and brave and articulate and moral. And honestly, with the coming economic turmoil, we need more than ever to be serious. And, you know, I did a stream 4 days ago. It was a fundraising stream. You know, one of my good friends, one of the activists we have, recently married. You know, Antifa's screwing with him, and he's in dire financial straits. You know, my show and the guys in my crew, we were able to pool together $500 and give it to this guy so he can, you know, fix his car and be able to work. There's no excuse, you know, I have such a small audience. You know, I don't make that much money doing this, but we were still able to do that. These bigger streamers really got to help out the little guys, because so many of our activists are despairing. So many of these men are despondent. Some of them are suicidal. I mean, remember that man after Charlottesville who killed himself because he got doxxed and nobody was able to support him? Whatever political leader is able to build the infrastructure to actually help get these doxxed activists jobs and actually improve their lot in life, I think is going to go far. And you know what? You said that you're a little bit of an eccentric, you know, you're a trailblazer. You know, I feel like I'm that way too. But all these men who are getting doxxed, we need to have it set up where, you know what? There is money in dissident politics. We need to then raise money and have these men work full time for the cause, because a lot of these guys simply cannot get jobs anymore because they've been doxxed. So Antifa and the system need to understand that every time they dox one of our men, they are creating another full time soldier that is going to dedicate every waking hour of their life to their destruction. So imagine if we have this huge mass of activists. I mean, think about how many organizations we can staff with all these great, talented men that have been doxxed. So these are the sort of things that are going to happen. It's an inevitable development. We just need these current political leaders to either get on board with it or get the hell out of our way, because we're out of time.
It is basically people join movements. You know, we're going to invoke a mid-century political movement because together they are stronger, you know. Individually, we are weak twigs, but together we form a mighty fascist, we could say, and we are unbreakable. That's what you're describing there is a mutual aid society. If we are going to be free, this includes freedom of speech, like freedom to express our views, we're going to have to fight for our freedom. We're going to have to earn our freedom in some way. And yeah, this is, I guess, one of our roles. Mutual aid society, that's a type of infrastructure, something that we should definitely look into to construct. We are, of course, here at Countercurrents building a national, we are building a policy institute. Now, it's going to be American focused. And a lot of the really smart, brilliant guys we have over in America, I'm sure they will be able to find some form of employment there. Wonderful. Or at least use it as a resource to make their own employment. So that's something to look out for. But definitely, we got to keep organizing. We got to stick together. We got to help each other, especially young guys with families. They need all the help they can get. It's something I'm a little sore about, I guess, now that I'm entering the stage of life where I'm no longer a young man, right? I'm just a man, still not an old man, but... is when I was young, nobody really helped me, you know? I didn't exactly forge my own path ahead, right, with zero help, but by the time people started helping me, I was already a little old, a little embittered, right? I was in my late 20s, and looking back on a decade of basically being shat on by older people, by older men in particular, I think it's psychologically toxifying to young men when they find themselves left adrift by their elders. And I just don't just mean elders by age, but people who are above them in a hierarchy, right? Even if you know they're younger than you or your age, if they're above you in a hierarchy and they leave you up shit creek without a paddle, this is not just something that hurts you at that moment or financially. I think this ruins people's ability to obey authority, right?
Yeah.
Because it's and that's really bad, because like you said, we are soldiers and this requires obedience, but soldiers won't obey if you treat them like shit.
No, they'll they might mutiny if you are bad enough, as we've seen in history.
And that's, I think, that's something to think about. We have more questions, we have more donations. We have a question from Phil Barker for $10, American. There's a lack of loyal elites in the U.S. who are committed to an American first agenda. Do you think a successful nationalist movement needs more Andrew Torbas to combat all of the elites on the other side? Ryan, okay, let's see what you think about that.
Certainly. Well, I do think that you know, we probably are going to get the majority of our funding, at least initially, from middle class people, upper middle class. We haven't really seen a lot of truly rich people supporting our agenda, at least to my knowledge. I'm sure there are many behind the scenes. But we, of course, need more men like Andrew Torba. And that's why, you know, we need to really circle the wagons. And when somebody like Andrew Torba does create a alternative platform, we need to support them, even if we don't agree with everything they do. Like, for example, you know, Gab was getting criticized by certain people because they were saying it wasn't as fun as Twitter. It's full of like Wignats or whatever. And I thought that was such a stupid, stupid thing to do, because Andrew Torba has done so much for our people simply by creating a free speech alternative to Twitter. So we might have to make our own elites. And what I mean by that is, you know, most of us are never going to be politically involved. Even I'm sure a lot of the people watching this right now are going to be supporting and maybe donating. But what we can do is we can vote with our wallets. And one thing that I really went out of my way to do is I would advertise this small company called Mighty White Soap Company, it's a pro-white family. They make soap. You know, it's very simple. But, you know, people use soap every day. So I was like, you know what, to my audience, I said, most of you don't have a lot of money. We're all students or whatever, but we got to buy soap. So you might as well buy it from the pro-white people, because we need to build a parallel economy. So, you know, if we all support companies like Mighty White Soap Company or whatever dissident business enterprise, you know, hopefully these businesses actually start making money. And if these people can become independently wealthy and successful, that's investing in them essentially. So maybe in the future they can support us.
Great. That's something to, and of course, I think I'm, I don't think they deliver to Europe, but when they do, I'm definitely going to order some of their fine products. Speaking of fine products, Alyaska Chaga is in the chat, and thank you, sir, for your donation of 25 library tokens. Those are on Odyssey. And he says, I remember CWC from the AF days, and I'm glad he's continuing with his own content. Keep fighting. Well, thank you for that, sir.
And thank you.
Your products are excellent. And of course, Alyaska Chaga has teamed up with Havamal Soapworks to produce their own soap. That's something else to consider. We might be getting a little bit, there might be the makings of a soap fight, soap competition, but competition breeds success. Competition breeds excellence. Or so I've been told by the free market people. Who knows? But it is that. Thank you for that, kind sir. And thank
I bookmarked their website. I'll definitely have to try their tea. Maybe I'll review it.
Excellent. I'm sure Mr. Chaga will be overjoyed to become a sponsor of the Culture War stream as well. Well, anyways, let's have a look at these questions. Beer Hall Pooch. He sends us. Yeah, I know. Best name ever, right? This is so funny. We're being attacked, so are winning, right? So yeah, DLive has indeed clipped our wings. And he says, Nix, as a Macedonian, can you come to England and teach us English? I think you speak English pretty fine over there in England. I wish I could speak English like a Brit. When I speak English, I speak like an American because I watch American television and films. When I write like a Brit because I think that the brain has two different centers for processing written and spoken speech. And I learned English from reading Victorian novels, right? So this is why my written English is so weird. We have, but yeah, I mean, I do have ESL moments. You can catch them. I actually have a database of them sometimes for my biographers, because, you know, I am a historic personage. The children in history class, they're going to want the funny trivia. You know, we have $10, 10 American dollars from Gadius Maximus over on Odyssey. And he says, press S to spit on DLive. Well, I'm sure it was just a misunderstanding. Until it's official, please withhold your saliva. We're going to try and work this out with the Chinese over at DLive. Maybe they're banning us over our stance on the Ukraine-Russia war. Who knows?
And I hope it wasn't me being on there.
I sincerely, I don't know. Even if it was, you know, I'm going to stand by our, my guest, because I've realized a long time ago, like ever since Nick Fuentes was banned and all these people, we are living on borrowed time over at DLive. You know, the right. This is not the first time the writer's block's been banned on DLive. The original disposition of the writer's block, where Full Moon Ancestry was host and I was co-host, was also banned on DLive, and we had it on Trovo for a while, and we streamed to my personal channel for a while. Now we're on the Countercurrents channel. But it is what it is, I guess. We are also right now streaming on my personal channel so that we can at least be on DLive, if nothing else. But we should be transitioning to Odyssey smoothly, I would say. That came out all wrong. And we have White Rabbit Radio, Mr. Tim Murdoch, with 88 library tokens. Well, thank you for that, sir. Nix, you always do a fantastic job in the in these interviews. I believe you needs a raise payable in your favorite beverage. Well, thank you for that, Mr. White Rabbit Radio. Thank you.
I remember watching his videos in middle school.
Wow. Let me guess. Anti-racist Hitler is the most popular.
And the one where they go, the colonists, the New World, they meet with the Indians.
Right. Tim Murdoch is a stalwart of this movement. You know, talk about conquistador. He was here before Cortez, right? He was in this thought space while we were, both of us, you know, we were wearing short pants. He was hacking at this jungle of anti-whiteism with his machete. And everyone should go over and subscribe to Mr. Murdoch. I appear on his show with some regularity as an independent sort of analyst. Most of the time we talk about cars and women, though. So sometimes about geopolitics, sometimes about how to organize a movement. It's always really cozy when you're the guest rather than the host, I guess. You just get to respond to questions. Speaking of questions, I think that's all of the donations for now. Now, Ryan, the reason why I wanted you on my show initially was the fallout from the American trucker moment. Now, we witnessed the Canadian truckers and what they did in February before everything just got consumed by the Russia-Ukrainian war. And we saw that that protest, for all its energy, for all of the honking and occupation of downtown Ottawa, ultimately failed to bring Trudeau to heel or even beat back COVID tyranny in Canada. Now, America just couldn't let it go. They had to try their own trucker convoys. So for anyone who may have not followed that story, would you care to relate a brief history there?
Wow. Well, man, that the trucker saga was hell of an ordeal for me because I was heavily involved in it. So I helped organize it to great effect. You know, we, like I said, I had that mass meeting with over 60, more than 60 people showed up in less than a day's notice. You know, we met at the local beer hall in Huntington Beach, and I spoke about revolutionary mindset, the strategic aims of the trucker convoy, and tactics as well, like how to conduct yourself in the convoy. And I also talked about what supplies we needed, the logistic needs of the convoy. And we were able to get all these primarily moms in Orange County. We had so many supplies donated. I mean, the immense amount of supplies that we gathered in such a short period of time was amazing. We had local small businesses, local warehouses were actually letting us use their space for free to hold all the supplies we had. This was a movement with a lot of potential, and it's something that people are very excited for. And Antifa was freaking out. Oh, this white nationalist is, you know, doing this mass movement with all the he's in a beer hall talking to the people and he's like telling them about revolution, you know. So they were like totally blown out of proportion, you know, freaking out, drawing parallels to, you know, certain historical figures, whatever.
Did you have any failed artists in your entourage?
Well, you know, I used to be something of an artist myself, but, you know, no, whatever. But
artist, drummed out of the military, speaks in a beer hall. Okay. Diagnosis confirmed. But do carry on.
I don't know who you're talking about, but.
Not some Australian guy.
Where was I? Anyway, so yeah, so we had this event. Huge amount of people turned out for the convoy. I was, I had a group of young nationalists who were there that came with me. We committed, you know what? We're going to go across the whole damn continent and we're going to stay. We're not going to leave DC until we win. And some of my posts on Telegram were getting 50,000, 75,000 views. It was blowing up, getting all this coverage. And all of a sudden, the grifters who were controlling the convoy, they slandered me. A bunch of these like weird militia types. This guy, Eric Rohde, who's the leader of this militia called the Oath Keepers, he went on this like twisted, unhinged 12-minute rant about me. And he's like, this little punk. And then he like he reaches into his shirt. He pulls out his necklace. That's the Star of David. And he's like, are you mad that I'm a Jew and I'm in charge of this convoy? I'm like, I didn't even know he was Jewish. And he's like waving his Star of David necklace, you know, bragging. And then so then they're like, you're not welcome here. If you see this guy, kick him out and let him know legally and lawfully that he's not welcome. And then I'm like, OK, you know what? This convoy is doomed to fail. Screw you guys. I'm pulling my men out of this because we're not going to spend thousands of dollars in gasoline to go with a bunch of idiots. And then guess what happened to the convoy? $1.5 million was raised. All the like money was stolen. The woman who was in charge of collecting the funds is actually a convicted fraudster. Wow. And this proud Jewish militia guy bailed and he left the convoy. Never to be seen again. So the whole thing fell apart. And it just really goes to show how, like, you know, we Americans have a lot of potential with protests. Like, people want to do something, you know. I mean, January 6th, hello, that was pretty, it's pretty hardcore, right? The problem is the lack of leadership. The problem is dissident right-wing people. I was the only guy to go on the convoy. So I didn't have support from, like, you know, AF or any of these other people, really. If I had more men with me, we probably could have just straight up taken it over, honestly. I just didn't have enough men or enough funding, really, to pull it off. We really tried our best. It was fun. It was a learning experience, and it really revealed some of the issues with these fake patriot organizations. There's a lot of grifters. Like I said, the people that took over this convoy, it was a bunch of Scientologists, Jews, militia people who have a lot of money, like millions of dollars. So I simply cannot compete with that financially. Now, if I had like 100 young men that would go, my cadre, the crew that I had were the only men under the age of 30 in the entire convoy. All the thousands of people that were there, we were the only men under the age of 30. So with me left all the youth. And of course, you know, the thing fell apart, but it's just insane, you know. But I encourage everybody to watch the video of this guy ranting. It's one of the funniest videos I've actually ever seen in my life. Not exaggerating. This guy was so unhinged. And I have it on my Telegram. I'll post the link in the chat just for later viewing. I think you guys will think it's funny. But, you know, these leaders that are like running the Patriot movement, they're not impressive people. You know, we are simply better than them. You know, we're better than them. We're smarter than them. We're more dedicated. We just need our guys to show up. So that's why I've really seen the need for a vanguardist approach building these infrastructures, because, you know, if my stream was a little bit bigger, if I was, you know, getting as many donations as I was like a year ago, I was going to rent like an RV and have like 20 guys go. You know, we're just simply not there yet logistically. But I'm convinced that in a year or two, once we've built up our infrastructure a little bit more, something like the trucker convoy, it'll end a lot differently because we'll be able to be like, you know, we're not going to leave.
Yeah, it's important to try in as much as possible, because you described this following of suburban moms you've cultivated. People do cry out for leadership. I remember writing an essay, like it was almost 300 years ago, I guess, or maybe three, I don't remember. It's called National Populism for Elitists, right? If you're an elitist, if you're a believer in elite theory, right, and you consider yourself part of an incipient elite, which, you know, in all my arrogance, I do, and I think you as well, the reason is you do not, the trick is not to look down on the common folk, but to understand that they are crying out for you and your leadership, right? And you're not over there to strut like you own the place. No, you're actually there to give direction and to give purpose, and then watch the miracle of well-organized white people at work, right? And I applaud your efforts. All I can say is everyone should go follow Culture War Criminal, follow Ryan Sanchez, see if you can't help him. In any ways, he's going to need funds. He's going to need your labor, I guess, if you are in Southern California or anywhere near. You know, a lot of hay can be made out of volunteer labor.
Indeed. And you know what? I just want to say, if you get nothing else from watching this show, anything that I've said, I just want to give a message of hope. Hopefully inspire the people that are listening. Because like I've said, the group of men we have here, and thank you very much for saying that, because, you know, support is desperately needed, but, you know, we have the men are there. The youth are activated. We have the numbers. And I have many men that have already committed. They've already dedicated their lives to this. They're willing to, you know, full time, do whatever it takes to win. So I'm very happy. Like, I know that if I have these guys here, I know that there's other groups just like mine all over the country. So hopefully we can get results and prove to the rest of the country, like, hey, you know what? Look how much we can do here in California. And then it's going to grow from there all over the country.
Excellent. Now, another thing I want to draw your attention to is we're going to be fighting on two fronts, right? If we're going to fight this battle, we're going to fight. We're fighting, of course, the primary enemy, which is the progressive left, whatever you want to call them, Globo Homo, Zog, Gay. There's been some debates about the nomenclature. Let's not get into those as well. But we are also going to be fighting with our other arm, the conservative establishment. And we just named them there. These militia types, these boomer conservative types, neocons, people who try to subvert conservative energies. And I've said several times that these organizations need to be deconstructed. First and foremost, we need to deconstruct their raison d'etre, show to people that these people cannot and will not protect you. Even if they could, they will not protect your interests. They will not protect you from, all of the dangers we are facing. I don't think we need to rehash them right now. Sure. And all they will do is take your money, take your energy, and pump it out into the void of space, like they did with the $1.5 million of truck money, gasoline money or whatever that they stole from. And another thing, right, I hate seeing this. I see it on Twitter from some of these people. You got to respect the grift. Sorry, I'm never going to respect the grift. Grifting should be a crime, even if it isn't. And many times it is a crime, right? One of the most precious resources we have in white societies is that we have high trust societies. It's when I give someone money for starving children or a political cause, there is a certain degree of confidence I have that actually, yeah, this money is going to go towards that cause. Now, I don't expect immediate resolution of the issue, but at least don't steal my money. And every grifter undermines that public trust we have. And this means that you reduce your societies to basically, and I live in Southeastern Europe, like I live in the Balkans. We are a low trust society. people don't trust each other. And even though we are, you know, white people of high intelligence, because we don't trust each other, our societies are, well, I wouldn't say crap, because that would be unpatriotic, but they could function better. You know? This is the cost of having a low trust society. People cannot coordinate and cooperate. And well, strike at public trust.
And that is why it is my understanding that our first priority needs to be the destruction of these false leaders on the right. And to that end, my crew here, unfortunately, like I said, we've been stabbed in the back by some people who claim to be fellow nationalists. And I responded, but I'm done, you know, dealing with this petty drama. My sights are now on the Republican Party, because I know that myself and my men, we are worth more and we are capable of much more than petty online drama. And I sincerely believe that we will take over the Republican Party in Orange County. We have multiple men running for office here in my crew. Many of them we haven't publicly claimed as ours because they're being a little more subversive. But we seriously do have a good shot at taking over the Republican Party, because we need to take over the right wing, the money and institutions, before we can then march on the left. Because we cannot ever hope in this corrupt political system to take on these multi-billion dollar leftist NGOs without money and numbers behind us. So traitors before enemies. And, you know, these rhinos are not very popular. And rhino is an American term, which means Republican in name only, you know, like fake conservatives, the ones that Trump railed against so much. So there's a lot of public hatred of these people. If we nationalists, with our vigor and fanaticism, can become the face of the opposition, take over the Republican Party, which, you know, nationally, we're not going to be able to take over the Republican Party, I don't think, but we certainly can in some locales like Orange County. And then we'll start striking back to the left. But I'm very hopeful.
Well, hope springs eternal, and I think you have it in you to do it, Ryan. I've certainly been convinced by our time together. We have another question from ABC for $5. There are some current events that have the potential to seed division and antagonism against our activists. The Ukrainian war is an example. As some of the leaders of this movement, how do you promote and enforce unity? What's the right stand? Take it away, Ryan.
Well, I see some people who are, you know, trying to praise one side of the conflict. Like, I see some people praising Russia because they think it's striking back at NATO, and it's like getting a dig in at the, you know, the Atlantic, you know, empire. Which, you know, may be true, but white people are dying. You know, this is a horrible war. War is terrible. It's so tragic, you know, all these brave soldiers on both sides who are dying, all the civilians who are dying, the devastation. You know, I am sympathetic with the nationalists of Ukraine who are fighting to the death for their homeland. I also understand Russia's motivations for wanting to stop the expansion of NATO. That is, if I was Putin, I would do the same thing, as terrible as it is. That's the burden of being a head of state. But I think we should probably refrain from, you know, glorifying the deaths of, or gloating at the deaths of our fellow white people, just because you're trying to be edgy. It's disgusting. And I think we should, those of us that aren't directly involved in the conflict, we should probably, you know, not get too involved with it. I just hope it's over as soon as possible. I don't want to see more people dying.
I think from what I've caught of your Telegram channel, I think even you and I, we might be on slightly different sides of this issue. But I do agree that we should not allow these things to, like, whenever we find a division in the dissident movement, in the nationalist movement, it's usually not about end goals. It's about the roads we take there, right? And more often than not, it's style, it's big egos clashing with each other. Now, big egos clashing with each other, I think, can be remedied if you grit your teeth and think of the cause, maybe have a sit down, maybe hash it out in private, don't allow it to spill out over in public. Whereas difference of methodology, we already have the social technology to solve that, and that is decentralization. Like Ryan's doing his thing over in Orange County, he does not really have the infrastructure to bother my thing over here in Macedonia, and vice versa. So let's not step on each other's toes, but let's work towards the common goal, which is the well-being of white people all over the planet. And I think that's one methodology we can use. Now, that's the theory. In practice, it's going to be hairy. People are going to have disagreements. People are going to maybe have public purse fights, and they're not going to be. Or we can make hay from that. Don't let Frody know I told you, but last night he had a debate. It was called Fight Club. It was invitation only. You had to buy a ticket to attend the debate. And he made a lot of hay out of E. Michael Jones and Greg Johnson debating the Russia-Ukraine thing. There were so many good memes that came out of that. It was one of the first times I was roaring with laughter at a live stream in a long time, right? And I feel sorry for anyone who wasn't there next time. I hope to see more people over there in that.
You know, I think we should... I think when we have disagreements within the right wing, I think we should settle it like men. You know, we should,
right?
You know, ideally we would duel, you know, or we should have, you know, settle in the boxing ring. And, you know, the guy that I've had the most issue with, the streamer, you know, Beards and Beardly, last night on my stream, you know, I challenged him to an MMA fight, and he has yet to respond. But I think if we just handled it like men, you know, if men were willing to back up all their smack talk with their fists, then I think, you know, things would run a lot more smoothly. So, yeah. You know, maybe we could do a charity event, you know, raise money for the cause.
That is actually an excellent idea, but although I don't think he's in your weight or height class. So there's one of this.
Well, he claims he towers over me. He claims he's so much bigger than me. I mean, I'd like to see him prove it then, you know, we all know it's not true.
Well, maybe he'll arrive into battle like a Master Blaster from Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, you know, on the shoulders of his wife's boyfriend.
Ex-wife.
Ex-wife. Oh, that's unfortunate. It's so, this is true. And someone who is a fighter, you know, kickboxing, Krav Maga, Wing Chun recently, though those Chinese, they know a thing or two about fighting, or so I've been told. I would say every man benefits from A, delivering a punch to someone's face, B, taking a punch to the face. It really builds character when you've been put on the floor by a left hook to the jaw.
I cannot take a man seriously who has not been punched in the face at least once. I mean,
right.
Even more than throwing a punch, you know, I think, you know, getting hit, getting your bell rung a little bit. You know, like it's crazy how many guys I talk to that have like never been in a fight ever, you know, just like in my age group. They're like, yeah, I've never been in a fight. Crazy.
It's I've noticed this. All the younger guys I hang out with and they're afraid of it. Right. And at their age, like they're 18, 19, they shouldn't be afraid of getting in a little. I mean, I've had my ass kicked for real. It's not that bad. I mean, it's bad, but it's not that bad. It's there are worse things than getting beat up. You can always get up. You can always dust off. And pride is cheap. So I guess that's one of those things. And other times, you know, you prevail, but you gain judgment, right? When to reach for the fist and similar weapons, and when not. And it's really moderates your degree of shit talking, you know.
Indeed.
So I guess it's just one of those things. Let me see if we have another one of another question. But yes, like I said, maybe we I think the left is so very successful because they know how to turn their weaknesses into strengths. The dissident right is going to infight. This is due to the fact that we are a contentious people, people who go out and disagree with all of the propaganda arrayed against us, right? This is literally every major institution in society tells you that you're wrong, you're stupid, you don't know what you're doing. The kind of person who nevertheless persists in what we're doing is going to be contentious, right?
So and, you know, if I can interject for a minute, actually, before I forget, this is actually a good point. You're contrasting us with the left. You know, right. One of my proudest achievements is I actually was the leader and the lead organizer of Orange County Antifa for 3 years. You know, I ran a counterintelligence operation. We had a little controlled op going here, me and some local pro-white nationalists. We actually ran this, and these idiot communists fell for it for so long. And the sad part was I was able to grow that organization a lot quicker than I've been able to grow the pro-white movement, because there's just a lot more people sympathetic to being Antifa, I guess. But from my time on the inside, I saw how much they're willing to work with each other. Like these, you know, Antifa is like the bad optics equivalent on the left wing. But, you know, I was a student at, you know, UC Irvine, and one of my professors was at a Democratic Socialist of America meeting. Like, I recognized him, and he recognized me. I was like, oh shit. Like, I hope he didn't like remember anything I said in political science class. But, you know, like all these institutions that have mainstream support, like their leaders are very much supporting Antifa. But the important thing is, even if they say we don't support what they're doing, you know, as the leader, you know, as the organizer for Antifa, they would still, after the meeting, come to me and go, hey, you know what? We love what you're doing. We just can't publicly support you. We need that on the right, you know, like our militants, we need our public facing, you know, guys to still at the end of the day be like, you know what? Whether it's said or unsaid, we need to be like, we're all on the same team at the end of the day, you know? But these Antifa, you know, the left operates in an extremely high trust society. Like our very first Orange County Antifa event we had a little, we did a cookout with the DSA, and this transgender communist, this like super autist, this dude was obsessed with East Germany, and he came wearing the raindrop Strichtarn uniform, you know? And he's like, oh, comrade, I have a, like, this freak was telling me about his illegal AK-47 that was made. It was manufactured in East Germany. It was an East German AK-47. Like, yeah, like, comrade, like, the fash won't know what hit him. Like, totally Fed posting. I'm like, this idiot doesn't realize that, like, I'm his mortal enemy, right? And he's just, like, willingly telling me. Like, if I was a cop, he would be screwed. But it just goes to say, they don't fear the police infiltrating them. You know, they can do all this illegal crap and get away with it. But they're very trusting, and they're very pathetic. And, you know, maybe I'm going to do a video on, like, I'm going to deep dive into all the funny stories I have from that, because these people are beyond parody, man. You have no idea.
I'm sure you have like hundreds of really fun stories about that. I'm just still trying to process the whole Ryan Sanchez, Darth Sidious of Orange County playing both sides of the Galactic Empire thing. It's really sneaky.
They fucking hate me here. Like, they, pardon my language, but like, they, Antifa really, really hates me here. And, you know, to this day, Antifa hasn't reconstituted itself in Orange County, because they fear that, like, my guys that are still, I still have guys that still operate Twitter accounts pretending to be leftists. You know, they don't know who they are, though. So they're like, you know what? They have Antifa in San Diego and in LA, but not in OC. They don't do anything here. And they never harass us. They never crash any of our events. Actually, we had two guys try to crash my event at the beer hall. And my security team escorted them out, you know, and that was the last we heard of them. So no one else has given us trouble since. So
this is all amazing. But it goes to show best defense is a good offense. You know, just get inside their heads. It's too often it's us hunting for feds, although we should be.
Inside their heads, and you know, the women want us inside their pants too. I have to say, you know, once I made my once I became a pro-I activist, and I was on Twitter, I had so many leftist, like non-white, primarily girls, sending me the most crazy, like raunchy sexual messages. Like these, like we could, if we wanted to, we shouldn't, but if we wanted to, we could, you know, we could totally cuck the left, literally. Like it's that bad. Like we, and you know, when we were infiltrating Antifa, obviously I kind of stuck out like a sore thumb, me and my crew. So my persona was, I was a Stalinist. I had to be a tanky, you know, I'm like, well, I have to be an authoritarian because I have the authoritarian personality. But you know, it was funny. Like we were like, yeah, we're like, we were being totally like LARPers, like calling everyone comrade and all this like cringy stuff. But, you know, the chicks gravitated to us, you know, not the stupid anarchist dude. And there's even a guy who was a former U.S. Army infantryman. He was a communist, but he definitely was close with us. He thought we were his friends because he identified more with the strong white man that was more militant than this like weird mystery meat, like anarcho, you know, communist guy. Cringe, right? But like, amazing. Look, moral of the story, we're so much better than these people. I don't fear them anymore. And the reason I realized that the reason I've crushed them in fist fights, the reason why I've always seen Antifa get folded like wet paper in a fight, you know why that is? It's because actually these guys wearing black, most of them are women actually. Like I didn't realize that. I thought they were skinny men, but I seriously believe at least half of their black bloc fighters, at least in America around here, are girls. So that now it's not as impressive to beat them in fights because when we did the OC Antifa events, it was mostly girls that showed up. It's all these like weird anti-white, you know, Mexican chicks or Jewish chicks. Actually, a lot of them were too, but it's very interesting. But yeah, Antifa, they're only a threat because the government protects them. But these people suck, man. They're just so pathetic.
And there are weak people who, when the going gets tough, I don't think we're even going to have to account for them. They're just going to melt away like snows in the spring. When I pretend to be a communist, I always LARP as a Brezhnevite, right? I always scold the Stalinists for being too extremes and the Khrushchevites for being too liberal. And I support Comrade Brezhnev's.
I'm a Whig com, you know. I'm full right, tanky.
Right. I'm more of like you know, 70s, early 80s Soviet Union, just when it was all falling apart. I guess that's just age catching up
cuck,
with me.
What a cuck, man! Liquidate the kulaks. Class war now.
But see, that's the thing, Comrade Sanchez. We have now become red bourgeoisie. We can live good life. No need for revolutionary fervor anymore. Come, drink vodka, eat pierogi, and maybe seal off stream with tell glorious audience where they can find culture war comrade.
Culture war commissar. Well, again, thank you so much for having me on the show. You know, getting platformed, you know, it means a lot, seriously. So to everybody watching, if you want to follow me, my primary social media is on Telegram. It's at Culture War Criminal, or you can click on the link t.me/Culture War Criminal. I'm on YouTube as well. Just search Culture War Criminal. It's under my name, Ryan Sanchez. I have a website, ryansanchez.us. And also, I'm on Odyssey. And wow. Tell me, is there going to be another Countercurrent show, a stream after this?
Saturday, there should be a show Saturday.
So I'm not competing with anybody if I were to go live after this, right?
Oh, Sundays. I think it's JF is doing a show, but we don't have a non-compete agreement with him yet.
Okay. Well, You know, I haven't really been streaming that much. I was thinking about going live actually right after this. Hopefully get to know some of the audience, let you guys know what my show is all about, and hopefully build the stream from there.
Right. So everyone just go sign up to Culture War Criminal on Odyssey and go there. People are asking, are you on Gab? Someone followed on Gab. Right.
Yeah, let me make sure I get you all the right link.
Right. So that's where you can find Ryan. You can find him on Telegram. That's where I follow him. And you can find him on Gab. And he's going to get his Odyssey channel working as well. We can speak more freely on Odyssey for the time being. Apparently not on DLive, although I'm pretty certain we did not break any rules and regulations on DLive. But it is what it is. So
they fear Ryan, the awakened Spaniard, I guess, you know.
Yeah, I guess they are afraid. Look, this, like, the Nords had their chance. Now it's us Mediterraneans. We're taking over the movement, and we don't fuck around, like we like to say in the old country. You got anything else to say, Ryan? I think we can retire to our comfortable beds now.
Sure. Well, again, thank you very much. I was looking forward to this for a while. I hope to work with you again in the future. I really enjoyed this. And for those of you who are questioning what my Gab is, I have my VPN on right now, so I'm not able to actually access Gab. Once I end this stream, I'll turn my VPN off, and then I'm going to go live on Odyssey and with my VPN off, and I'll confirm for you guys all my links are proper. So thank you just for having me on.
Can you just, I think you, people found you on Odyssey. I'm not sure. Let's see.
Yeah, it's at Culture War Criminal.
I'm sorry about this, people. It's a little shambolic. The DLive deplatforming midstream has.
Yeah, sorry about.
Has really taken, I mean, it almost took it out of me there. But, you know, we resonate together, energy flowing between us, and all of that hippie crap. So I guess this has been the Writer's Block with Culture War Criminal, a.k.a. Ryan Sanchez. I'm your friend and host, Nick Gildy, and you can catch the replay. I think Wednesday-ish it's going to be done on the Countercurrents website. It's going to be behind the paywall for a month, but after 30 days, you can listen to it for free, for freeloaders. I'm sorry. I want to thank the audience. I want to thank our courageous moderators. I want to thank everyone who donated. I want to thank Ryan once again for showing up. And until next time, bye-bye, people. Bye-bye.